Carl Stewart is an investment advisor representative of Carl Stewart Investment Advisor Incorporated. Call or text Carl now at 512-836-0590. Now, here's Carl.
Good afternoon and welcome to Money Talk. I'm Carl Stewart, and you're listening to News Radio KLBJ. Thanks for listening. We're here this afternoon, closing in very soon next Saturday on our 27th anniversary Money Talk. This is always a broadcast about the world of financial and investment planning, and always you determine the agenda by calling or texting 512-836-0590. Also, you may listen online right now at newsradiokobj.com or go there at your convenience and download podcasts of the last several years of Money Talk. And this coming Friday at 6 p.m., we will rebroadcast today's show. It's always a terrific idea to call at the beginning of the hour or text. I will take the calls first and then the texts, and then after that, if I have any carryover texts from previous weeks, and then the much-feared and universally maligned bloviation comes on after that. So if you think that's a threat, you would be correct. Call or text 512-836-0590. Jeff, you're on the air. How may I help?
Well, Carl, I am one of your longtime guys that's been here a long time listening to you, so, and you've always been very helpful. So
good. Thank you.
Well, I have a joint account that belonged to my mother, and then I got involved as part of it.
Yes.
Well, I just lost her, and I'm trying to understand cost basis. Does that now change since I'm on here as a joint account?
Yes.
Since I don't know if that falls in the same category as inheriting.
Yeah, great question. Here's my understanding, and neither one of us, I'm guessing, I know I'm not, as our CPAs, but here's the deal. In some states, I know that when married couple have a joint account and the first spouse dies, the step-up in basis occurs to half of the portfolio value. But it's my understanding in Texas that the survivor of a joint account, I need to say this for the rest of our listeners, Jeff's well aware of this. What we're talking about here is what I call the taxable environment. We're not talking about IRAs, 401Ks, 403Bs, SEP IRAs, or Roth IRAs. We're talking about taxable accounts in your name or you and your spouse's name, or in this Jeff's case, his and his mother's name. It's my understanding that because you were joint owners, upon her demise, the market value at her date of death becomes your new cost basis. So you are subject to the step up in basis, which, of course, other than the sadness and tragedy of your mother's passing, is probably one of the best tax deals there is, because if she's been and you with her have been long-term investors and we've had a very good stock market, you're going to avoid those capital gains if and when you choose to sell by getting a step up in basis. Now, again, we have a lot of, you're a long-time listener, you know, so you know we have CPAs and tax experts who listen to this. If I'm mistaken, because it's your mom and not your spouse, we'll know probably today. But it's my understanding, if it's a joint account, the joint owner gets a step up in basis.
Well, and thus the reason for being a longtime listener and also one of your attendees from way back when.
Boy, you are going back a long way.
yeah. We go back a long way, Carl, when you first started. So, and I realize, thank goodness for the people that do listen that are also longtime listeners, that they could correct this. So it would be whatever that cost base it is for that date, unless we hear otherwise from the other experts that are out there.
Yes, yeah, that's exactly it. So I know you're a listener, so keep listening, and we'll confirm that, Jeff. Thank you, sir.
I appreciate it.
You bet. Thank you. You're listening to Money Talk on News Radio KLBJ. Call or text 512-836-0590. Here is a text. Hi, Carl. What is your opinion on purchasing and owning a single-family rental property within a self-directed tax-deferred IRA? I'm retired, 66, and looking to add income. So it's an excellent question. Let's just talk about two parts: owning a single family resident rental property and putting it in an IRA. In my experience, the traditional IRA custodians, banks, mutual fund companies, credit unions, savings and loans, and traditional broker dealers are not going to offer an IRA that will allow you to do that. Now, a lot of people call what you're considering self-directed. I have a little problem with that because you can open an IRA at Fidelity and tell them what to invest in, and that's self-directed in my view. But nevertheless, there are trusts, banks that specialize in these types of IRAs, and you can buy real property in there. Of course, you're going to want to understand the need for liquidity because you're going to have, depending on your age, eventually required minimum distributions, and you can't sell a bedroom to meet the RMD, so you got to be really aware of that. Of course, the annual fees are going to be a bit more, but that's not, in my opinion, a barrier to entry. So I'm not opposed to that idea. Now let's just talk about it regardless of where you domicile it. You, of course, understand that you're taking what we call concentrated risk. You're going to have one piece of property in one market. And so the vagaries of that market, both good ones and bad ones, you will be subject to that. And, of course, also, as regular listeners know, I always say what I've learned and what I've observed are the people who own rental real estate, the ones who are really successful over the long term, but not just lucky because the market's going up, are those people who tend to be hands-on type individuals. They enjoy the process. People who are not hands-on people are going to have lower returns because they have to hire a property management company, and that's an ongoing expense. And also, there's a hassle factor. So I can tell you that I was a residential real estate rental property owner. I had the great pleasure, quote unquote, of suffering through the real estate decline back in the 80s in Austin and Central Texas. And like the old joke about the boat owner, my two happiest days were the day I bought the property and the day I sold the property. I learned an important lesson, even though I lost money, which is that was not for me. So number one is your personality, your time, and your interest. And then secondly, understanding the risks of having a concentrated investment in one real estate market. If you're okay with that, and you're okay with the loss of liquidity, putting it in a so-called self-directed IRA is a perfectly reasonable thing to do. Thanks for the text. You're listening to Money Talk. It's time for me to take a break. It's also a great time for you to call or text 512-836-0590. I'll be back.
You're listening to Money Talk with Carl Stewart on News Radio KLBJ, 590 AM and 99.7 FM. Enjoy the podcast on newsradioklbj.com. Now, here's Carl.
Welcome back to Money Talk. I'm Carl Stewart, and you're listening to News Radio KLBJ. Thanks for listening. We're here this afternoon until 5. When you have a question, call or text 512-836-0590. Here's a text. It says, "Hi, Carl. What is your opinion?" No, that's the wrong one. "Carl, I always look forward to your Saturday show. Thank you. Are you familiar with reverse line of credit? And if so, any thoughts?" I am not. Certainly heard of reverse mortgages where you have a home with lots of equity and you really, really, really need income, probably in retirement, and having a reverse mortgage taking money out of that equity and not having to pay it back until the house is sold. But this is a reverse line of credit. It may be similar, but I have not heard of that, so I'm sorry I can't help you. You're listening to Money Talk on News Radio KLBJ. Call or text 512-836-0590. Here's a text and a comment regarding our earlier caller, I beg your pardon, text person on owning a single-family rental property in a self-directed IRA or taxed-in IRA. It says another consideration for property in a self-directed IRA is how dealing with required minimum distributions can prove not as straightforward, especially if it makes up a large allocation of one's overall qualified assets. You know, that just makes sense to me, because the required minimum distribution is determined by the year-end value of the investment. And if you're a limited partner and the general partner asserts the value, I would guess, that would be one thing. But if you own it personally, getting that December ending value could be problematic. So if anybody who's listening has dealt with the required minimum distribution by owning a single rental property in an IRA, I'd be very interested in hearing about it. You're listening to Money Talk on News Radio KLBJ. Call or text 512-836-0590. I came across a really interesting article in today's Wall Street Journal in the Intelligent Investor segment, where it said that Vanguard shareholders and a couple of Vanguard target date funds ended up having a bad experience. They own these funds in their own taxable account, first of all. Most people, when they encounter, in my experience anyway, encounter target date funds, they're typically in a defined contribution plan like a 401k or a 403b, and they can be used easily in Roth IRAs, SEP IRAs, and IRAs, but they're designed to have asset allocation change over time as you approach the target date. The thrust of this article is that Vanguard had cheaper shares for larger retirement plans, but it had something like the $100 million or $50 million minimum, and they lowered that minimum to $5 million. And so many plans moved to the lower cost shares, which of course was totally appropriate, and Vanguard had to sell the underlying securities to redo them in the other fund share class, apparently, according to the article. And people who owned that target date fund, but owned it in their own taxable account, ended up with a significant capital gains distribution that they didn't anticipate. So I think the lesson there is perhaps that it's not prudent or wise to own a balanced, I beg your pardon, it is balanced, but own a target date fund in a taxable account, or if that's the case, you need to be very, very careful. You're listening to Money Talk on News Radio KLBJ. A text just came in. Let's see what this has to say. It says, Carl, for a long-term taxable account planning to invest in the S&P 500, would you recommend the mutual fund or the exchange-traded fund version? Also, if it matters how you answer, I'm in the 35% tax bracket. My experience regarding taxes on exchange-traded funds and broad index funds, and that's what you're considering with the S&P 500, is that the sponsors of the large funds, I'm thinking of iShares from BlackRock, Vanguard, and Fidelity, that they manage those large index funds like the S&P 500 or the total stock market to be tax efficient. And so I know that exchange-traded funds are designed that way, but I believe that they manage their open-end funds, the so-called 40 Act funds, in a similar fashion. So depending on if you're making a single investment or infrequent investments, that may be a factor. Only if your custodian or broker-dealer charges a transaction charge. Some do. Some will buy and sell ETFs on your behalf with no transaction fee. And if that's the case, and if you can buy the open-end fund with no transaction fee and it's from the same sponsor, then it really comes down to the operating expenses. Usually, in my experience, the operating expenses of the exchange-traded fund are lower, slightly lower than the open-end fund. The reason to use the open-end fund would be if you were going to pay a transaction charge, a $15 or $20 or $10 transaction charge, and you were going to be investing, let's say, every month, for example, then or taking out every month because you would pay for buys or sells, then the open-end fund with no transaction charge would be to your benefit. But if the transaction charges on both the open-end and the exchange-traded fund are the same and they're both zero, then in that case, I would choose the one with the lower expense ratio from the same sponsor, and that would be the exchange-traded fund. great question. You're listening to Money Talk on News Radio KLBJ. Call or text 512-836-0590. Here's the text. Carl, imagine if someone had 100% of their qualified assets, that means in a tax-deferred environment, how would you take a distribution? I would guess a custodian would have suitability restrictions. Well, I would tell you how I would do it. I'll answer the first part. As you probably know, and long-term listeners know, I'm a huge fan of focusing on asset allocation and matching that allocation up with your own risk and return expectations. In other words, if you've got let's say you're 65, so you've got a 25-year investment horizon, you don't want to get too quickly into cash or bonds because inflation is your big risk. But let's just suppose, to make it really simple, that you have a 60-40 stock bond allocation and you have $1 million market value and you want to take income from that and you want to do $2,500 a month. That's $30,000 a year. What I would do, because I see this occur in the real world, is you would take it in such a way as to sustain your allocation, because you're going to have years like 2021 where stocks are going to outperform bonds, and you're going to have years, if today were December 31st of 2022, bonds, while down, have outperformed stocks. And so you're going to want to sell assets because you don't care about the tax consequence to sustain your asset allocation. That is a huge and really important lesson. It just drives me crazy when I'm invited to webinars to talk about generating income in retirement. If you generate an income in retirement by buying below investment grade bond funds, for example, or below investment grade preferred securities, or high dividend paying securities, and interest rates rise or a recession occurs, both would be likely plausible in the foreseeable future, you're going to have downward pressure on those. Secondly, you may have to pile in too much of those assets to get you the income that you need. I think you're much better off treating that qualified money just the same as if it were a defined benefit pension plan, where your asset allocation is a function of your risk return expectations, and then taking it ratably from that. So in a bull market for stocks, you'd be taking more from your stock fund portfolio. In the bear market for stocks, you'd be taking more from your bond fund portfolio or whatever other non-correlating assets you might have. Over long periods of time, what you're doing inadvertently, perhaps, is rebalancing. You're selling your winners and not your losers, and that is a very good thing to do over the long term. Thanks for the text. We're coming to the bottom of the hour. It's time for me to take a break. I don't have any phone calls coming in, and I've finished all the texts, so now's the time to do so. 512-836-0590. I'll be back.
You're listening to Money Talk with Carl Stewart on News Radio KLBJ, 590 AM and 99.7 FM. Enjoy the podcast on newsradioklbj.com. Now, here's Carl.
Welcome back to Money Talk. I'm Carl Stewart, and you're listening to News Radio KLBJ. Thanks for listening. We're here for about, what, another 25 minutes. So if you have a financial or investment question, call or text 512-836-0590. Also, you may listen online right now at newsradioklbj.com, or you can go there anytime you want and go to the, I think it's called specialty section or specialty something or other at the website, and then you can click on there and you can see Ed Clements and all the other wonderful people and yours truly as well. You can click that and go to all the podcasts of the last several years of Money Talk. And if that's not enough, then this Friday after at 6, actually, right after the news, we will rebroadcast today's show, 512-836-0590. Here's a text. Carl, thanks for the help you provide your listeners. You're welcome. I'm 61 and plan to work another 2 to 4 years. I have $3 million plus in retirement plans and annually contribute the max. I currently do not plan to withdraw any retirement money until required minimum distribution forces me, and am currently in the 35% federal tax bracket. I have a Roth 401k option. Should I contribute to that for the next few years versus a traditional 401k? So for everybody else who's listening, I think very good change has happened in the 401k world, and I don't know, I assume, I hope in the 403b world, is that you can put pre-tax contributions into your 401k account at work, or you can put after-tax contributions into the Roth 401k. Then when you retire, you can roll over that Roth 401k that has after-tax contributions and taxable growth, non-taxable growth, into a Roth IRA. And then you're not subject to the required minimum distribution at age 72. And if you wish to take the money out, it comes out income tax-free. If you predecease your spouse, she gets it. If she then, or he, is left with money in there when they pass away, then your beneficiary gets it, and she or he has 10 years to take the money out, all tax-free. So in this case, you, the person who texted me, have plenty of assets probably. You're at a high income tax bracket. And the idea now that you're going to have a lot of money subject to the required minimum distribution, I really like the flexibility of a Roth IRA. So if I were in your shoes, yes, I would stop doing pre-tax contributions and do after-tax contributions. I'm a little fuzzy on this, but I believe that the employer contributions will still be pre-tax. That's my understanding, but yours will not, so that you'll start to build up over the remaining 2 to 4 years that you're working that pool of capital. And then you can retire and have an IRA rollover if you choose, and a Roth IRA rollover. And then if you fall into a lower tax bracket from the 35% bracket, you may even want to consider whether or not you want to begin to do some conversions and be willing to, if you're willing to pay the taxes once you've retired, and move more capital on an after-tax basis over to a Roth IRA. But if I had that chance today, based on your age and based on the amount of assets you have, I think it's a terrific idea. So good luck. You're listening to Money Talk on News Radio KLBJ. Call or text 512-836-0590. Matt, you're on the air. How may I help?
Good afternoon. I have a question about I-bonds, U.S. Treasury I-bonds. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Can a person, I'm aware of the $10,000 annual contribution limit that an individual can do.
Yes, yes.
Is that per person? Like, can a grandparent set up a custodial I-bond account for one grandchild with 10 and a second different name grandchild for another 10? Those are separate accounts. Do you know if that's legal, possible?
I believe that it is, and here's the reason why. A custodial account, the minor, your grandchild, is the actual owner of the account, even though you have control, because when they reach the age of majority, your name, the custodian's name, will be dropped, and it will be theirs. And so my view, and again, you and I are not tax experts, but my view is that there are two separate accounts for two separate people, even though you're the same custodian. So my best guess, you know, I'm fairly confident, is you would be able to put the maximum in each of the accounts because the accounts are owned by two different people, Matt.
Good. And then that would mean other people couldn't put in anything to that because it had already been maxed out, that one account. Is that correct?
That would be my – that's logical.
Yeah. Right?
If it was just –
10,000
if it were
account. Yeah.
Right. Right. If it were a custodian account and they wanted to put something else in there, they could put cash in there. But it would seem to me that the annual limit would be subject to each account. That would be my best guess.
All right.
Yes.
Okay. What's your crystal ball prediction? Interest rates are going up. It's like, how are you going to lose? It sounds like it looks like a really good deal.
Yeah. Yeah, it looks like rates are going up. The Federal Reserve is very cautious about how much they're going to go up. The market's right now telling you that inflation is going to be stickier than the Federal Reserve says it is, that it's going to last longer. It's not going to stay at 7%, but it is, however, likely to move to the higher end. So right now, the I-bonds, the downside is, of course, the limited amount you can put in. But the upside is, yeah. I'm told, they look pretty attractive today. Yes.
Yeah, like the sky's the limit. Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Bye.
You bet. Good luck. Thank you. Bye-bye. Thanks for calling. You're listening to Money Talk on News Radio KLBJ. Call or text 512-836-0590. Here's the text. Call. I've had a self-directed retirement strategy for the past 40 years. My asset allocations have become out of balance relative to my strategy over time, but I have not made adjustments as of yet. Is this something that can be addressed all at once or should be adjusted over time? That's a terrific question. My rule of thumb, and that's what it is. It wasn't something that I learned in the book. This is, as listeners know, I've lost money in every conceivable asset class. You're listening to a guy who lost money in Austin real estate, which makes me a genius. So I'm going to tell you my rule. If I use the 5% band, so if my, and I'm not recommending 60-40, let me be absolutely clear about that, quite to the contrary, but just for purposes of discussion, if you have a 60-40 allocation, you've been investing for 40 years, and we've been through bull markets and bad markets, bull markets and bear markets. My guess is that you're heavily overweighted in equities. Now, unless you have changed your asset allocation thinking or your risk tolerance because you've watched the ups and downs of the stock market and you didn't lose a lot of sleep in the dot-com bust and the global financial crisis, then if you're not comfortable with the next 40 to 50% decline in the stock market, whenever the heck that's going to happen, then you need to rebalance out of equities into non-correlating assets, which excludes real estate investment trusts, master limited partnerships, preferred securities, and high yield bonds. Okay. Not those. If then you should do it. And when should you do it? If you want to stay true to yourself, you want to do it on Monday. First of all, we both know the tax consequences are you're going to have to think about that. But if it's in a retirement account, a qualified account, self-directed, as you say, then that's not an issue. And if it's not, you're going to be subject to the capital gains tax, which is a lower rate than the income tax. But I don't see the benefit of dollar cost averaging out of an asset allocation. It seems to me the concept in all the academic data I read is it assumes rebalancing once a year. Well, if you rebalance at the end of the year, I'm just making that up, there's nothing magical about December 31st, then you do it at one time. So if you're 80-20 and your allocation target 60-40, you need to take it back to 60-40. So that's what I would do if I were in your shoes. Great question, and congratulations on your 40-year tenure as an investor. You're listening to Money Talk. I'm going to take a break. We're coming up on our last quarter hour. You're running out of time. If you want to call or text, 512-836-0590. I'll be back.
You're listening to Money Talk with Carl Stewart on News Radio KLBJ, 590 AM and 99.7 FM. Enjoy the podcast on newsradioklbj.com. Now, here's Carl.
Welcome back to Money Talk. I'm Carl Stewart, and you're listening to News Radio KLBJ. We're here for about another 11 minutes. If you've got a question, call or text 512-836-0590. Marianne, you're on the air. How may I help?
Hi, Carl.
Hi.
Our recent market has corrected for days, maybe weeks. Not anything like what we're having right now. And so
right.
I was just, you get kind of rusty and expect more of the same. But my call really is to ask you, are there some strategies we might use at this time with the correction and certainly stocks going down?
Anything
you could?
I think it's a terrific question. And you're a long-term investor and a long-time investor. And so am I. And we both know that when you go, we've had now three consecutive weeks of down, and the NASDAQ's been hurt more, and that's been driven by the tech stocks, particularly. Stocks like Netflix are down sharply. And some of it is fundamental. As the market's trying to discount the outlook for earnings growth in a rising interest rate environment. The academics would say that growth stocks, which typically pay little or no dividends and in many cases are selling at high multiples of earnings, because the future earnings at Apple or Amazon or Meta, which was Facebook, or Alphabet, which is Google, are so great that people are willing to pay more for those future earnings. But as interest rates rise and you apply that discount to them, the future earnings become worth less. That's one possibility. The second is that if you were going to be taking profits, given the leadership that five or six stocks have had in the S&P 500, you'd probably become overweighted in that area if you owned individual stocks as an institutional investor. You might sell some of those because you have large profits and you're in the process of rebalancing. All of that's entirely plausible. The other thing is that rising interest rates also hurts people who borrow money to buy investments, because the cost of borrowing the money goes up. And so you have a lot of those, what I would call headwinds for the stock market. And I think the other thing that most Wall Street analysts would say is that the 2021 earnings gains in the S&P 500, which were over 20%, approaching 25%, are not going to happen again in 2022. And so there may be a reevaluation of how much people are willing to pay for future earnings if they return to a more normal set. And then, of course, you continue to have the COVID risk. So you have rising rates, moderation in corporate earnings, and the unknown, what's the next variant, if any, after Omicron. So the question becomes, for the person running her own asset allocation, is a 10% decline in, say, the S&P 500 or a 15% decline in the NASDAQ, you'd have to look at your portfolio and say, okay, because I know you're a hands-on investor, what was my allocation on December 31st, stocks, bonds, cash, et cetera? Within the equity allocation, what was my allocation there after a good year, 2021, with a 20%+ return in the S&P, and what is it today? You might be surprised that it's not down very much. If it's not down very much, then I wouldn't do a darn thing. If you, on the other hand, had taken greater risk and you were in the higher volatile, high earning, high PE part of the market, where maybe you own sector funds that have really been hurt hard, like the famous ARK Innovation Fund, that's a different deal. If you still believe in the underlying fundamentals and you've got a 30 or 40% decline, then buying more of that is perfectly reasonable. But if you're a broad index owner, you probably, even though a 10% decline is significant, you probably haven't had that much to do. And I would say, and that's the case, let's say you had 60% at the end of December and it's off 10%, that's 6%. Now you got 54%. I don't know that if I had all my money in the S&P, I don't know if that's enough to get me to move, Marianne. I think I'd wait this thing out. If it bounces back, then you're back where you were at the end of the year. If it goes lower, you know, if it goes down another 5 or 7 or even another, you know, if it goes down another 5 to 10%, yeah, then it becomes worthwhile. But I'd be slow to pull the trigger personally.
I sure appreciate you going over that. That does help my thinking process.
Good.
And thank you, Carl.
Okay. You bet. Thanks for calling and thanks for listening. You're listening to Money Talk on News Radio KLBJ. Here's the text. Let's see. Carl, what about taking dividends as distributions from an equity ETF? Does it matter whether you withdraw during a stock bull or bear market? So I am not a fan of taking dividends for income. I know that sounds crazy, but when I look at the returns over long periods of time, and how much of the returns are attributable to reinvested dividends, it's just amazing, whether they're bond funds or stock funds. Take an individual stock. So this is a point of view. It doesn't mean I'm right. But I know we have listeners who might have bought, so let's just pick a good quality company that pays dividend. Let's say Procter & Gamble. You bought Procter & Gamble 25 years ago. Today, the dividend yield on what you paid for it is ridiculously high because they've raised the dividend over the last 25 years. And you could say, I've just got a rising stream of income, and you'd be absolutely right. What I like better is what would have occurred if you had reinvested all of those dividends every quarter over that 25-year period and taken a modest income from it and only increased the income by selling shares when you absolutely needed to because of the rising cost of living, which was modest until recently, was moderate until recently, I think you'd be better off. So I'm a huge fan of reinvesting dividends, and if it's in mutual funds, reinvesting dividends and capital gains. And it's really beneficial in the taxable world because you're raising your cost basis, what's called to your adjusted cost basis. So when you do sell shares, you have a smaller long-term capital gain. So it's okay to take dividends, but I don't do it personally and would not recommend it because I think there's huge power in reinvesting dividends, and I would be more comfortable doing that. You're listening to Money Talk on News Radio KLBJ. Here is a text. Carl, in a couple of months, I'll be 62 and am still working. I do not need the additional income, but any suggestions on how to figure out the best age to start drawing Social Security? I will tell you what the experts say. The worst time to draw it is 62. Sadly, I don't know if it's 50%. It might even be more, but it's a huge percentage of Social Security beneficiaries take it at 62. That's just for most people, unless you have a life-ending diagnosis or a life-shortening diagnosis and you're single, that just is a terrible idea because the benefit is so much greater at full retirement age than it is at 62. And at 70, good gracious, it's 8% a year more between full retirement age and 70, and there's no investment that you can make that's going to get you 8% a year. So if you don't need the money, let the government compound it for you. You're not paying any taxes on it, and you're still working, and there's no reason to take it 62 because if you're working, some of that benefit will have some kind of tax penalty that I've always been confused about. So I would say for most people in most circumstances, you're much better off postponing it at least to full retirement age. Then at that time, you can do the math and say, okay, this is my benefit of full retirement age. This is my benefit at age 70. Now, how long am I going to have to live where I'm going to get more money and the aggregate from waiting till I'm 70 and versus full retirement age? That's a worthwhile thing to do. So again, I would not take it at 62 if I were in your shoes. We're down to our last minute. I just want to say for tee this up for next week. I play tennis with three friends, and one of them told us last week that his grandson said, "Grandpa, how do you know if you are rich?" What a terrific question for a young person to ask. And we talked about that, and I've given a lot of thinking about it this week. And what does it mean to be rich? I just think that's a fascinating question, and I encourage you, whether you're a first-time or regular listener, to think about this week. And if I have some time next Saturday, we'll have a good conversation about that. Speaking of next Saturday, and oh, by the way, Tiger, thank you for doing a terrific job. Thank you for listening. Next week after the news at 4, be sure and tune in to Money Talk.
Carl Stewart is an investment advisor representative of Carl Stewart Investment Advisor Incorporated.